major glacial event might actually last only, oh, 100,000 years, perhaps a little bit more, and then the rest of the time was so-called interglacial periods. And of course, it caused major fluctuations in plant life, animal migrations, all kinds of things. So there's a lot that we still don't really know about it. In our area, what we see primarily, at least certainly here, is the result of what we call alpine glaciation, glaciers that formed in the mountains and then came down the mountainous areas, as opposed to the large ice sheets, which, if you are a Midwesterner, well, you're more familiar probably with some of the effects of that. Minnesota's 10,000 lakes and all this sort of thing, almost without exception, are the result of glacial activity. My son said it's really not true. He said that they say 10,000 lakes. He said there are 9,000 lakes and 1,000 wet spots. Anyway, the fact that there are lots of lakes in the Midwest certainly attributable to glaciation. In our area, the glaciers are, as I say, we call them alpine glaciers, and virtually all the terminology that we use to describe various aspects of glaciers revolves out of the Alps, where glaciers were first really looked at in some detail, and so most of the terms are either French or German. But this would be perhaps a typical alpine glacier. It starts up here in a basin area that we call the cirque, and if there is enough accumulation of snow and ultimately of ice, then the glacier will begin to move down the valley just like a very slow-moving stream. And in fact, glacier systems are often, well, most of the time they probably follow old stream drainages and stream patterns, and so they have small tributary glaciers just like we see small tributary streams. The glaciers will pick up rocks and debris as they go along, some of which falls off the side and lands on the ice, and some of which the glacier simply picks up from the floor over which it moves. So the glacier is kind of like a great big heavy file moving down the valley, scraping, using those rocks and things to scrape and scour the basin. Typically, there's a point somewhere on the glacier that would be determined maybe next month sometime, and above that point, which we call the fern line, is the area where there is more snowfall during the winter than will melt during the summer. So this is called the accumulation area. Below the fern line, the glacier is still flowing, it's still moving, but there's more melting going on than there is accumulation. So typically, not very much of last year's snow is going to survive down in the so-called ablation area. And the glacier will move down the valley until the melting circumstances essentially bring it to a halt. It goes down, and finally when there's enough melting, why, it simply ceases to move or advance. It's still flowing internally, but it may not go any further down the valley. If the system gets out of whack to the point that ablation starts to exceed accumulation, then the glacier begins to retreat. And that's what we see now in almost all of our glaciers, is that over the last, well, especially 150 years, the glaciers have been undergoing a fairly dramatic recession or retreat, because the accumulation just simply isn't enough to keep them anymore where the end has been, and so gradually they're melting back upstream. Any place that the ice is stressed, it will form crevasses. This might be an irregularity like you see here. It might be a steep part of the glacier. It might be simply a place where the glacier is moving unusually fast for some reason. There's no such thing as average rate of flow. Most glaciers probably would move maybe, a few inches a day, maybe in some circumstances a few feet a day. Unusually fast ones go more than that, but slower ones may really go slower, but it all depends a lot on the circumstances on what the budget happens to be. This is a snow line. This is the kind of thing you hear about in the winter, perhaps, when at least out in our part of the country, when somebody says, well, the snow level or snow line is at such and such an elevation. Well, here we are along the Columbia, and you can pretty much see where the snow line is. Now, this is obviously not like the glacier. This is a one-day happenstance. It's probably by later in the day or by the next day, most of that snow would probably gone, or certainly the snow line would tend to fluctuate. Here's a glacier just to the north and west of us called South Cascade Glacier, and this is really a pretty good example of the little diagram that you saw. Here's the accumulation area up here, and you can see last year's fairly nice fresh snow still covering the surface. And so the fern line is right in here someplace. The glacier is going over a really steep area, and so it's pretty well crevassed, and then down at the end it spreads out, so it also shows some crevasses. But all this gray then is actually open ice, and it's pretty much free of last year's snow. There are a few little patches there. And you know, the snow will cast in shady areas and stay lower than the fern limit. But typically, you can find that on the glacier without any trouble. So this was taken, mid-July, so here's a fairly well-defined fern line. But that probably didn't last on through the year. It would gradually move up glacier until the end of the year. So it's not a fixed point. It depends very much on what the total accumulation is for the year. If it's a big snowfall year, then the fern line may stay fairly low. If it's a poor year, then it will move relatively high. But glaciers don't respond to one year's change. If the glacier is undergoing a pattern of recession or a pattern of advance, that's the result of a fair number of years of change in the budget system. So if it's time when there's a lot more snowfall for a period of years, then the glacier will certainly start to advance further down the valley. But you also have to keep in mind that it still is flowing internally. It's still moving, even though it may, in fact, be retreating. Here's Mount Rainier. Mount Rainier is, well, kind of like a big marshmallow sundae, I guess. Most of the snow and ice accumulation takes place fairly high up, and then the glaciers just kind of radiate out from that upper point. But I suppose when this was taken, the fern line is maybe somewhere in here. And again, this was late summer, so it probably changed a little bit. The glacier may actually tend to pull away from the area of the beginning. The basin in which an alpine glacier starts is what we call a cirque. And usually it's kind of an amphitheater, like half a bowl. And if the glacier moves down and actually stops for a while, then it may build a moraine at the lower end. So the pattern is fairly well defined. This is a picture of one of the glaciers in the Juneau Ice Field. And here the glacier again is coming out of a big central ice mass, flows over a very steep area, and the glacier just absolutely disintegrates, the surface anyway. And what happens is that the upper surface of the glacier, the upper, let's say 100 feet or so, is relatively brittle. So as the glacier moves, why, this tends to break up and fracture. But look what happens further down. It begins to go back together and make some very distinct ripples, well-defined ripples, and each one of these represents, in this case, about a one-year flow. And then finally, down here, the ripples begin to disappear, and then they just show up as lines going down through the glacier. So you can almost count, I don't know, 25 or 30 years of flow in this particular glacier. But it does give the idea that the ice is very plastic.
How deep are most of the glaciers?
Well, they have to be in excess of 100 feet to even begin to move. So there's a lot of variation. This one is several hundred feet thick. I don't know, the ones up here that you see, like the ones on Bonanza Peak, are probably maybe 150 feet thick, something like that. During glacial times, the North American continent was covered by a really massive ice sheet, or continental glacier as we call it. Actually, the accumulation area was probably around Hudson Bay somewhere. Don't get the idea that the glacier started at the pole and headed out from there. The pole is ice. Water, really. It's ocean. The glaciers have to accumulate on a landmass. So in North America, at least, they started up in this area. And then they began to move, for the most part, southward, although some parts of the glacier actually flowed north into parts of Alaska. Some rather sizable areas of Alaska were never glaciated during the so-called ice ages. But they moved down here. There are no barriers to speak of, so the glaciers went well down into the center of the continent, into Kansas, Nebraska, way down into pretty much the lower Midwest. As we go westward, then the Rocky Mountains start to provide a barrier, and the glaciers poked into the U.S., but only as kind of fingers and not nearly as extensively. And then, of course, all the mountainous areas were also glaciated with alpine glaciers, as we call it, mountain glaciers. So this happened, again, pretty much time after time after time, ending about 10,000 years ago or thereabouts. This is the Greenland Ice Sheet. This is one of the few remaining so-called continental glaciers, or large ice sheets, this one and the one in Antarctica. And so one would almost imagine then that the Midwest might have looked like this for a good many years. I don't know how much would actually peak up out of it. And then along the fringes of the ice sheet are places where there are what we call outlet glaciers, glaciers that flow away from the ice sheet and ultimately out into the ocean. So there are fingers of glaciers that stick out here and there.
What happened to Iowa, though? It seemed like you got cheated. Minnesota's got 10,000 lakes, and Iowa's got almost nothing. And it's in a driftless area. I noticed in your...
Well, yeah, there's an area in upper Wisconsin, the so-called driftless area, where there was enough barrier here in terms of rocks and rather resistant areas that it diverted the ice sheet around, and so that little segment up in the, I don't know, was it the Baraboos or in that part of Wisconsin were never glaciated. It's a little hard to know why, when you get way down the lower end, there are fewer lakes. You get great deposits of glacial moraine and tills and rocks and things like that, but certainly not the lake patterns. And it may be some difference in the way the melting occurred. Most of the lakes we see are the result of blocks of ice being finally separated out from the glacier and then forming ponds or lakes as the glacier melted. And you find that, you know, if you get up into the Dakotas, they show a lot of the same kind of lake patterns that you see on into Minnesota. So, I don't know, it's a little hard to know why Iowa got so left out as far as lakes go.
Is there evidence of thermal moraines?
Yeah, but they're not terribly obvious.
Yeah.
There is, in Wisconsin, the Kettle Moraine Park area statewide, or maybe it's Federal Park now, anyway, the lakes are so-called kettles, and the moraines are the end deposits, and there are moraines. They aren't terribly well defined sometimes, but they certainly flow up through the country. This is one of the big glacial accumulations coming off the coast ranges in Alaska, where individual glaciers have flowed down out of the mountains, and then they collect and accumulate and then flow on out toward the ocean as kind of a big continuous mass. You can see some of the flow patterns in here, the way the ice is tended to move. Now looking at the Cascades, here's a small alpine glacier, a valley glacier. The end of it is right in here. But it's also quite obvious that sometime in the not too distant past, the glacier was at least this big, based on the fact that it's trimmed the side of the valley and left a very distinct lateral margin. So our glaciers have very much receded. These glaciers are the result of what we think would probably look at as being the Little Ice Age. We don't honestly know if these are actually left over from the so-called main ice ages that ended 10,000 years ago, but are more likely ones that formed in the so-called Little Ice Ages, which really began about 1300 or thereabouts, and for all intents and purposes came to an end only about 150 years ago. So sometimes you can look at pictures in the alpine areas in Europe and see diagrams, woodcuts and things showing the glaciers right up almost to the edge of the villages sometimes, and now the glaciers are almost totally out of sight. They've receded so far. So been a dramatic change in the last few years. This is typical alpine terrain. Here's a small glacier in a cirque valley, and it's flowing down like this. One thing about glaciers in the alpine areas, they leave real distinct fingerprints. One could look at a mountainous area and tell almost instantly whether or not it's been glaciated by the topographic and physiographic patterns that are there. And this kind of rough, jagged terrain is really very typical. Here's another cirque glacier sitting in a cirque, flows out. The fern line is probably right in here. Crevasse pattern as you come on down the glacier. This is Boston Glacier, probably the biggest cirque glacier in the North Cascades, and that's Mount Baker. That's Glacier Peak off in the background. So this is not too awful far north of us here, but big, massive, large-scale cirque glacier. The terminology that we use in describing glacial events, points like this, the high kind of sharp peaks that you see are called horns. The Matterhorn in the Alps is really the classic horn. The sharp edged ridges like this are called arêtes. If you do crossword puzzles, you need a five-letter word for a mountain ridge. Why a rep just always works wonderfully. R-E-T-E. They look like this sometimes, very very sawtooth and jagged, depending on what the rocks are like. Sometimes they're very long and smooth and sharp-edged, but a very typical glacier pattern. Look at Bonanza Peak up here behind us. This is Isella Glacier. This is Mary Green Glacier that sits right up above Holden Lake. And now as you look up there, you can see some of the crevasse patterns, and you'll see some of the classic kind of blue ice reflection, refraction patterns that show up snow gets off the top and the fresh ice starts to appear, why it really takes on that nice blue color, which is to a large degree kind of a reflection of the blue sky. So as a glacier moves down through a valley, the glacier is like a big rasp or file, and it will grind the valley down to provide the least amount of resistance to flow. And the least amount of resistance to flow is something that's is kind of U-shaped or smoothed out, so the glacier tends to scrape out or grind down anything that seems to be kind of an obstacle and ultimately shape the valley into this nice U-shaped pattern. Now, we see about as many shapes of U's as there are glaciers because there are all kinds of factors involved, like how big is the glacier and how hard are the rocks and how fast is the glacier moving and what kind of stuff is it carrying, and so there are lots of variables, but they all still amount to that nice U-shaped valley. So when the glaciers have left, then we begin to see the patterns that is left behind, the sharp peaks that are horns, the ridges which are arrests. The term col is an alpine term for a mountain pass. So you know, I don't know if you need a three-letter word for a mountain pass. Well, C-O-L always works nicely. This a little bit ill-defined. In the Alps, it was a way to get from one mountain valley to the other, so they went through usually to a low spot in the arête. But exactly what, how low it had to be, or what really constitutes a col is sometimes kind of argumentative. As the glacier moves down through the cirque or out of the cirque, the flow pattern is kind of a down and out flow system. So it has a tendency to scour out the bottom of the cirque. And when the glacier melts away, if it does, then that basin will commonly end up being a lake. And this lake is a tarn, four-letter word for a mountain lake. It's simple. A tarn is simply a lake that sits down in the bottom of a cirque basin. As the glaciers move down through the system, the big glaciers, because they are larger and more erosive, tend to carve their valleys deeper. The small glaciers, which aren't as long and aren't as erosive, are not able to cut their valleys as deeply as the big ones. So when the system melts away, then we find the original glacial valleys, smaller glacial valleys, entering the main valley well up on the valley side. And these are what we call hanging valleys. If you've been around Yosemite Park or seen pictures of Yosemite, probably almost every geology textbook uses one of the Yosemite hanging valleys as an example, but most of them aren't quite like that. But that's a fairly typical pattern.
You know, if you go back to that picture, in the lower right-hand corner, that sketch is so much like where we are right now.
Almost.
That hanging valley is kind of like this valley here. And
It isn't quite as steep or quite as spectacular, but...
And then, of course, the U-shaped valley at the bottom is Lake Chelan.
But the pattern is very much there.
Yeah.
Holden Lake is a tarn, beautiful tarn. Sits right down in the great big cirque basin. Mary Green Glacier is still up here as a remnant of the glacier that used to sit in this valley or in this cirque, but just one of a really spectacular example of a tarn. And this is true really of most alpine lakes are sitting in glacial valleys. Here's another one further up in the Cascade. You can see the cirque basin here. Classic alpine terrain. Here's Dumbbell Mountain. Here's the remnant of a cirque. Dumbbell really is a glacial horn. Big arêtes going down both sides of it. So we look around and you find just spectacular examples of alpine glacial topography. The North Cascades are absolutely incredible, and unfortunately this is about the only way one can truly appreciate the North Cascades, and that's to get up in the air somehow, either climb to the top of one of the peaks, which is at our age is probably not terribly likely, or get in an airplane and fly over it like this and truly be impressed, because virtually everything you see, and there are lots of glaciers still in the North Cascades. In fact, probably about 65 or 70% of the glaciers in the lower 48 states are in the Cascades. But everything you see is alpine, arêtes and cirques and horns and the whole ball of wax. As the glacier moves along, it's very much, as I say, scrapes and polishes the bedrock that's there, and what and how it does this depends a lot on, again, on what the bedrock is and what the glacier is actually carrying. So we find lots of signs of places like this where the glacier has scoured down and striated and polished the rock. This is something that's edge of Mount Rainier, where again the rock has been smoothed down and polished and shaped by glacial flow. This is something that many of you have probably seen or walked by. Anybody, any hikers? Or this one? Nobody's ever seen this? Boy, I'm going to have to get you out and educate you. This is along the 10 Mile Falls Trail. Both of these are good examples of bedrock that's been scraped down, smooth, polished by the glacier. So they don't show beautiful striations anymore. They're a little covered with forest duff and so forth, but really excellent examples of how the glacier will smooth down and polish the.
Is the big rock face up at Lyman Lake there, to the north of Lyman Lake? Is that?
Well, it probably is to some degree. The glacier that came out of Lyman went over that as a big ice fall, so it certainly has probably done some polishing there. I've never climbed up that face, so I can't say for sure. This is one of the valleys north of us that's actually a tributary to the Skagit River, but classic glacial valley. It's hard sometimes to know quite how big the glaciers were. Here I'd guess maybe the ice was up to here someplace. Sometimes we can see by the valley shape about how large the glacier was. But sometimes like this, when the vegetation comes in, the trees cover it, and it's not quite as easy to
Is there a distance between the Hanging Valley Glacier and the glacier below, or do they just...
You mean in terms of the length of the Hanging Valley?
Well, in terms of the vertical distance, is there a...
Yeah, it depends a lot on local conditions in Yosemite, why there are places where the vertical distance is 1,000 feet or more. Here it isn't nearly that much.
So the glacier could have gone up into and above the lip of the...
Oh yeah, it would definitely be higher than the lip of the Hanging Valley.
So it really didn't fall off into an empty space?
No, they just merged like a stream system. The lateral glacier would essentially flow right in and merge with the glacier going down the big valley. So.
How many feet of water would have been taken up on the ocean when the ice age was at its...
Well, the water level went down probably 500-600 feet, something like that. When you see illustrations of the lateral areas around the U.S., the borders of the U.S. were considerably larger than they are now, especially on the East Coast where the continental shelf extends out quite a long ways. The actual shoreline was considerably offshore from where it is at the present time. So it was a pretty substantial change. This is Railroad Creek Valley, looking from the upper part of the valley down toward the village. Here's the tailings accumulation. Beautiful U-shaped valley, just an absolute classic. But you do have to get up someplace where you can kind of look up the valley, get up on the tailings or get somewhere up. I don't even remember whether this was on the Heart Lake or Old Lake Trail. Either one, you can turn around and look back down the valley and get that view. Here's the view from the tailings looking back up. Here's the falls coming out of the Heart Lake. So it's a real classic. Holden Lake Then up here is, comes out of a hanging valley, and that's a pretty typical pattern. So it means that certainly the glacier was somewhere up in here in terms of size, because again, they tend to merge as more or less a uniform surface. So the big glacier coming out of the Lyman Lake area was certainly at least that thick. A little bit different view. Here you can see the more classic shape of the Holden Lake outlet. This is pretty typical of most hanging valleys. They aren't all like the Yosemite ones where they come out with a great spectacular waterfall. More like this, in our part of the country, they come out with a kind of major cascade where Holden Creek kind of boils down this from the mouth of the lake down to till it joins Railroad Creek. So it's a pretty standard pattern. Just as beautiful a hanging valley you'd ever want to see it. Right behind us is where Copper Basin is. And here's just a classic big U-shaped valley. And again, Copper Creek kind of tumbles out of that valley and down into the Holden Creek area, what has been captured to generate power. So it's a beautiful hanging valley. This is where Big Creek comes into Railroad Creek, and again, a classic hanging valley. So it's pretty country. A little bit different view. We were coming back from Europe one year, and when I'm in an airplane, I'm always trying to figure out where I am. And coming across Canada while I'm headed for SeaTac, why it's hard to find yourself out in the Canadian provinces. But as we started into the Cascades, I started recognizing different places, and finally here came Holden Lake and the lip of Holden and Mountain Bonanza Peak up here, so it was kind of neat to see some familiar faces after a long time. Looking from Martin Ridge outward, here's Holden Lake over here, Mary Green Glacier and Bonanza Peak and the main glacial valley here, Hart Lake, and then of course Lyman Lake up around the corner. So it's beautiful glacial terrain, the big classic erupts going up the side of the Bonanza, and here's Glacier Peak off in the background. In our part of Washington, the continental glaciers came down the valleys here to the north and out onto what we call the Columbia Plateau, this generally flat area that's in here, and came down probably in the vicinity of something like this. So this part of the upper area was actually glaciated. South of us, there are lakes in here. This is Lake Cleellum, Lake Cochise, Lake Ketchelas. If you've been over Snoqualmie Pass, you drive along the side of Lake Ketchelas. But on the map like this, we see that they're very distinctly parallel lakes, long, skinny lakes. These are finger lakes. Finger Lakes come out of Upper New York State. I call them the Hiawatha Lakes, Cayuga, Onondaga, Seneca, where the glacier moving through northern New York scoured the valleys. When the glacier left, those valleys then were refilled with water, and they take on the long, skinny shape of a glaciated valley. And so they were called Finger Lakes. They look like the fingers all splayed out like this. Well, the same thing is true here. These are all finger lakes. Lake Wenatchee is a finger lake. Lake Chelan is the ultimate finger lake. Lake Chelan sits in a huge glacial valley and probably is the epitome of a finger lake in terms of size and so forth. So we look at Lake Chelan. Now, Lake Chelan, in all honesty, doesn't greatly resemble a typical glacial valley. In fact, a lot of times the Finger Lakes don't. Some of you that might be familiar, well, drop another name. When you get up in the northern end of the Olympic Peninsula, Lake Crescent is also a Finger Lake, a long, skinny, narrow lake. But anyway, until you get out and kind of crawl around the sides of Lake Chelan, it doesn't look terrifically like a glacial valley, except for the very steep vertical sides. You don't see the U shape because the lake level tends to mask the fact that the bottom probably is U-shaped. But as I tell you on the boat, or as you read different places, the depth of the lake is around 1,500 feet, and actually it's almost, a little over 400 feet below sea level at the very lowest part. So the glacier really did a job of scouring out the basin. Down at the lower end, there's a rock barrier that essentially impounds the lake. And that's basically the same thing that happens with Hard Lake. It has a rock barrier where the waterfall comes out, and Lyman, pretty much the same thing. Sometimes the lakes, the Finger Lakes, are blockaded by glacial deposits that form kind of a dam or temporary dam. A lot of them have been modified by putting a dam on them. I think the level of Lake Chelan is raised, I don't know, 20 feet or so some years in the past in order to try to stabilize the lake level and also provide for some outflow for power generation. And most of our Finger Lakes are the same way. Lake Wenatchee and Cleellum and Cachalot and Cochise all have small dams on them to stabilize the lake level and make it larger for irrigation or whatever it happens to be. This is Lake Cochise. This is just off Snoqualmie Pass, and this is one that you really don't see unless you're trying to venture into it, but it's, again, a very classic Finger Lake. Waters up the valley here in an old glacial valley, and all kinds of scour marks and everything along the edge. Pretty classic one. As you go back down the lake, pay a little attention to some of the valleys that come into Lake Chelan, and you'll begin to recognize them as hanging valleys. These have also been modified to some degree. If you were to look at this one head on, it wouldn't look like a hanging valley because the stream that flows down through it now has cut a deeper channel, and so from a head-on view, it loses that appearance of a hanging valley. If you look at it a little bit obliquely, like the picture was taken either going up or going down, then it's pretty obviously a nice hanging valley. This valley is a hanging valley. It's pretty tough to see and photograph, but the glacier that came down here ran into the glacier, the much larger glacier that was going down Lake Chelan. And so this valley is a hanging valley. And if you stop and think for just a moment, think about your trip here. When you get in the bus and start in, you get about a quick 1,000-foot run back and forth up the face of a hanging valley. And then get up that 1,000 feet, and all of a sudden the valley levels out and you get a fairly nice gradual ride the incline into the village. Railroad Creek over the years has very much scoured out one side of it. If you've ridden on the outside of the bus coming up, why, you certainly are aware that it's a good long ways from the road down to the creek for the first little ways up the valley. But it hasn't totally changed. And that's common oftentimes in alpine systems where the valley, even though it's a glacial valley, has been reoccupied by a large stream. And that streams make V-shaped valleys. And so they'll recarve the system into a V-shape if they have enough time. And so always the shape of the valley isn't truly necessarily indicative of whether it's been glaciated or not. because the stream certainly can redo it. The glacier is also makes some rather distinctive deposits. This is one of the glaciers coming out of the Canadian or the ice field up in Canada. And you can see some of the deposits out here. So these are moraines. These are places where the glacier has actually formed deposits along the fringe. And again, this glacier is receding. So at one time it was up high enough to actually build moraines here or moraine over here. Now it's gradually going backwards. Here's another one in the Cascades. And you can see the deposits along the edge. This would be a what we would call a terminal moraine. So this means that this particular glacier at one time stayed in this one place for quite a long time. The glacier is like a conveyor belt. And it will move along, and if it reaches a point where it's stable for a long period of time, then the conveyor belt pushes stuff off the end, off the end, off the end, and gradually builds a big terminal moraine right at the end of the glacier. Well, this is not a Corps of Engineers design, so typically once the glacier has receded, then meltwater and the stream system will start to whack away at this, and so terminal moraines are sometimes kind of come and go because they don't serve as a very permanent barrier. The lateral moraines, the ones along the side, often survive much better because oftentimes they're above the erosion level of the stream. Around here, if you look at some of the places where they've done some bulldozing or cutting, this is what we call glacial till. The glacier hauls all this stuff along, and when the ice begins to melt, it's just simply dumped. It's a repository of everything from big rocks to sand to silt. Everything the glacier is carrying is just simply dumped. So looking at the deposit, there's no sorting. There's everything from rocks that are bigger, much bigger than your head, to very fine material. No layering, which is typical of most stream deposits. So this is a pretty classic glacial till, and you can see these almost anywhere along the edge of the valley here. Going down Lake Chelan, again when you get almost to Fields Point, you'll see some, I'll call them terraces sitting up here alongside the lake. And these mark, again, probably at a very minimum, the depth of the ice as it went down through Lake Chelan, because these are deposits that formed as the glacier was gradually melting and streams began to run along between the side of the valley and the edge of the glacier, and they made these deposits, and you see little remnants of them now along the side of the valley, especially down towards the, from right near Fields Point and a ways on down the lake. So it gives you at least some idea of how big the glacier was. And this doesn't mean that's necessarily the lower limit or upper limit, but certainly gives some kind of a target to get an idea of how big the glacier was. Glaciers also tend to grind up the rocks as they move them along. You know, you have all this stuff the glacier is carrying and instantly grinding one rock against another or scouring up some of the bedrock. And so the streams that come out from the end of a glacier oftentimes carry this ground up material. We call it rock flour. And so right below a glacier for a ways, why the streams will tend to look like this. They look very, very milky. And so you get to some place where you find something called White River or Milk Creek or a name like that. You can bet your bottom dollar that when that was first named, it was named because it was coming from a glacier. Streams that carry stuff that they pick up along the way are look muddy. They're brown and muddy looking, and that's certainly not rock flour. But the rock flour gives the stream a very definite color. As that stuff gets further away and gets more and more disseminated in the water system, then it causes the light that comes in to be refracted and everything comes out green. And so here's a lake, here's the end of the glacier here, so the rock flour is being washed out in the lake, it becomes more disseminated and the lake takes on this odd greenish color. And again, I don't know, I can name you any number of lakes that are in the Northwest that show this particular color, or along the Columbia Ice Field, or any place you happen to be. It's simply the fact the rock flour is very fine material in suspension in the water, and the refraction causes this odd greenish color. Heart Lake shows the same pattern, not quite as sharply as the other one, and sometimes it depends on the time of the year and how you happen to look at it. The stream that comes in to Heart Lake is decidedly greenish, milky looking, but pretty much a classic glacial drainway. When the glaciers came down into the valleys up here, the big ice sheet came down the drainage of the Okanagan Valley up here principally and pushed down along the Columbia, and actually they blocked the Columbia. Grand Coulee over here, which is a fairly long, deep channel running down through the Columbia Basin area, is the result of that blockage. The glacier actually blocked the Columbia through here, diverted the river down this way, and the result is ultimately the formation of Grand Coulee. It's a little more complicated than that, but we'll leave it at that. When the glacier melted, the stream then went back pretty much to its original channel because this wasn't cut deep enough to be a permanent channel, so it went pretty much back to its original form. But anyway, the glacier blocked the lower end of Lake Chelan, and there was certainly some meltwater in that glacier, even though the glacier was occupying the valley way on up here. In fact, there are indications the ice sheet probably pushed up that valley a little bit. In fact, there's some indication that the glaciers coming down Lake Chelan weren't just simply alpine glaciers, but might have been a little bit of spillover of the big ice sheet that came across a low area further north. So it was kind of a complicated combination. But anyway, the glacier blocked any water from flowing out what we normally see as the end of Lake Chelan. And the result was that the meltwater spilled over this ridge here, flowed over the ridge and down into the Columbia right here. And as long as that happened, the water kept carving valleys and carving valleys, and so it made a fairly deep valley that's known as Knapp Coulee. I don't know whether you drove in here or not. I suppose some of you likely did and went to Fields Point. If you came from the south, you likely turned off here and went up to another meltwater coulee called Navarre Coulee. And that comes out about 15 miles up the lake, I guess, from Chelan. But it's also a meltwater channel. It appears the glacier pushed back up this way a little bit further and cut off the drainage again, so it began to cut another new channel. So there are two really parallel drainage ways here that lead out of Lake Chelan down to the Columbia, and they both now have been used as roadways to get up to the lake if you come up the west side of the river. John?
I read about some huge lake that broke open all at one time and scoured massive areas. Not so far away. Where's that at?
Well,
where do we go here?
Let's get by it, I guess. Should have left it where it was. That's another story, but The lake that was out here was primarily in western Montana, called Lake Missoula. And the glacier blockaded the outlet of the Clark Fork River, which constituted or formed a huge lake. And eventually the lake broke through the ice dam, and the water then came across all across this whole area. And you can see through the Columbia Basin, all these little funny channelways, we call them coulees, but these are channels that were carved by what are generally called the Missoula floods or the Scabland floods. Rather spectacular array of erosion channels in the Columbia River basalts and in some of the overlying rock material.
That happened at one particular period? Or?
Well, it was late in glacial times. There are still some arguments over how far back they go, because like a lot of things associated with glaciation, it's hard to get a handle on it. But the last cycle was probably, looks like there might have been 70 or 80 different nearly catastrophic floods. Each time the ice dam would break, the glacier then would reform and poke its way across the opening and start it all over again. And so every 100-150 years or so for a fair while, during the latter part of the last glacial cycle, this happened time after time after time. Initially, the geologists who worked in there thought it was probably, maybe three or four floods, but now it looks like it was a lot more than that. Oh, I think somewhere in the next week or two, we'll deal with that a little more in its entirety. Anyway, this is Knapp Coulee. This is the Highway 97 way into or out of Chelan, but a very nice deep valley. One of the things that's striking to a geologist, and most people don't pay attention to, is here's a really nice stream valley with what? No stream. Certainly made a nice way to get in and out of the valley, but again, one of these kind of things I think most people will probably drive through without giving it a thought, except it was a handy way to get there. Any questions I can answer?
As far as we know, we're still in an ice age?
Well, now there's always a good question. The cycles that have occurred in the past, as I say, the glaciers have been very cyclic. We've been out of the last major cycle for about 10,000 years. Since we don't honestly know what caused them in the first place, I guess we can honestly say that we're in or out of the ice ages. The interglacial periods between glaciations lasted typically 200,000-400,000 years. So I guess maybe the safest thing to say is we're not going to have to worry about it. You and I are anyway. But no, we don't honestly know. Since presumably it was something astronomical, we're not sure what brought it about. So we're not sure whether the cycles are over or not. Probably the human race that we know now doesn't have to lose sleep over it.
What were the theories? What were some of the theories bringing on Randy?
You mean what caused it?
Yeah.
Well, probably the most common one now is what's called the Milankovitch theory. He's gone back and looked at the orbital pattern of the Earth and how far it is from the sun and the tilt of the Earth's axis, and made all kinds of calculations looking at those different things with the idea that the combination of being further away from the sun and tilted away from the sun is, these kind of things may cause glaciation. The one problem is that the glacial events were worldwide. They occurred in the northern hemisphere, the southern hemisphere. You see the same patterns in Europe. It wasn't just something that happened in North America. We see the same patterns in the southern hemisphere, but not to the extent, because the continents in the southern hemisphere are much further away from the polar areas. So the southern part of South America was glaciated, a little bit of southern Africa was glaciated, but the patterns aren't nearly as obvious. Beyond this, there are a lot of things that might explain one cycle of glaciation. People talked about long periods of volcanic eruptions, which would cool the atmosphere because of contamination and bring about a long period of cooling. So most of the things don't do very much to actually explain why the cycle was repetitive, why it happened time and time again. And that's been the big hang-up in most ideas.
But what was the other part of the Earth looking like that was not glaciated?
Well, generally cooler climates, more precipitation. Get out into your part of the country, and an awful lot of the erosion patterns that you see down there are the results of the climatic pattern shifting further south, and lots more precipitation, lots more cutting of arroyos and valleys and gullies, and now places that obviously were stream valleys at some time, but now don't carry water ever except maybe during a gully washer or something like that. So a lot of climatic variation, a lot of migration of animals and plant life as they shifted to cooler, warmer areas, and gradually caused transition. You know, these things don't happen suddenly. The glacier didn't just tear down and occupy the lower level. They advanced over a long period of years, and so there was plenty of time for plant life and animal life to migrate and adjust to most of what went on. So it wasn't a catastrophe in that sense.
You mentioned between ice ages that the Earth was warmer than it is now. How much warmer?
Well, there's a most climatologists say that to bring about a so-called glacial cycle, that it wouldn't require very much cooling, 10 or 15 degrees, an average temperature might be enough to trigger it. Warmer, hard to say, but probably again an average of a few degrees a year warmer than it is now. Certainly there were times when, again, the ocean level went up by a matter of 15, 20, 25, 30 feet higher than it is now. So a lot more of the ice was melted than what we see at the present time. So it's a little hard to put hard and fast figures to some of these things, but you know, the changes are not drastic in many cases. I mean, not as drastic as we might think anyway, just in terms of what would bring an alteration. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.